Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Taoism, following the way, the yin and the yang.
Tao gives birth to one. One gives birth to two. Two gives birth to three. Three gives birth to 10,000 beings.
10,000 beings carry yin on their backs and embrace yang in their front, blending these two vital breaths to attain harmony. What is Taoism?
Part of the ancient wisdom of the East.
Is Taoism a religion? A philosophy? A spiritual practice?
Taoism is the way to peace and harmony with all of creation. The hidden unity beneath the boundless multiplicity of existence.
Is it really better to sit on the banks of a remote mountain stream than to be emperor of the whole world?
Our guest is Brian Van Norden from Vassar College.
Taoism, following the way. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. Ken teaches philosophy at Stanford, and I did for many, many years.
Today, we're thinking about Taoism. We're following the way.
Taoism is one of the greatest and oldest philosophies of China, Ken. The big figures were Lao Tzu and Xuanzi. And their books, the Tao Te Ching and the Xuanzi, are very readable and thought-provoking. They're classics, still widely read, not only in China, but translated into all the major languages.
You know, John, I'm impressed. I didn't know you knew so much about Taoism.
To tell you the truth, Ken, I don't. But Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, said, "Those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know." So by that criterion, I can speak, since I know very much.
Well, I know a little bit about Taoism. I read a lot of it when I was in college, but I hope Lao Tzu wouldn't say, "I know too much to be able to speak."
Well, particularly not since we're on the radio.
Yeah, right.
Now, do you know enough to tell me this? How ancient is Taoism in comparison to the ancient philosophies of Greece, to the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle?
Well, they're about as almost as ancient, or roughly as ancient. Xuanzi was born, I think, about 30 years after Socrates died, and Lao Tzu was a 6th century BC philosopher, a little before Socrates, but I think about the same time as Heraclitus, for example.
Now, Heraclitus, there's an ancient Greek who, as far as I understand things, thought a little bit like a Chinese Taoist. He's the one that said that being is in constant flux, like a river, and you can't step into the same river twice.
John, I didn't know you got around so much in the ancient world. You're quite an expert on these ancient wisdoms, eh?
Well, to tell you the truth, we all know at least a little bit of Taoist wisdom.
Well, give me a for instance.
Well, a journey of 1,000 miles must begin with a single step. That's straight out of Lao Tzu.
You know, my dissertation advisor used to say that one to me all the time, Ken, to urge me to get started.
Yeah, my mother used to say to me, "Great acts are made up of small deeds." And my father used to say, "Silence is a source of great strength." And I've also heard that from my wife, Frenchie, and from you, Ken.
And you never heed that advice, do you, John?
No, not if I can possibly
help it. In all seriousness, we don't want to make it sound like Taoism is just a bunch of homilies. I mean, the two key texts, as you've mentioned, are the Tao Te Ching and the Xuanzi, which is named after its author. The first contains a lot of quotable sayings. You've given us a sample. And the second contains a lot of stories and parables and paradoxes and dreams and fanciful dialogues. But, you know, there is a kind of, as I understand it, well-worked-out philosophy of Taoism. But that doesn't emerge from these guys. It emerges from what later Chinese thinkers made of these two texts.
So, Ken, you're telling me that Lao Tzu and Xuanzi didn't really invent Taoism?
Well, neither of them ever heard of the phrase Taoism, I don't think, and most likely Xuanzi never knew anything about Lao Tzu, but they certainly inspired Taoism. The term Taoism was, I think, from later scholars who applied it to what they thought Lao Tzu and Xuanzi were getting at. But think about Christ. He didn't use the term Christianity, but he certainly inspired Christianity by later theologians.
Okay, I get it. Now, Tao is usually translated as the way, Not entirely clear to me what that means.
Well, in the way, it's basically the way things are, the way things have happened and will always happen in nature. And I think the thought is something like the way things happen in nature should provide a guide, or does provide a guide, or can provide a guide to the way individual human beings do things and the way human institutions might work.
Yeah, but nature, it doesn't change very fast, and it's sort of mechanical. It sounds like kind of a rigid and inflexible philosophy.
Well, they didn't think of it that way. Taoism was pluralistic, it was egalitarian, it was non-authoritative. It stood in sharp contrast to Confucianism, as I understand it. Now, that was a philosophy based on hierarchy and tradition and deference to the wisdom of the ancestors and all that stuff.
Well, I like this deference to the wisdom of old people idea, but at any rate, how is Taoism different?
Well, because when that turned to nature and away from mere ancestor worship, I think it's supposed to have made them less rigid, far more likely to question authority, to reject prevailing social norms, and open to human spontaneity.
Now, there's also a religious aspect to Taoism, as I understand it. We haven't said much about that. Which came first, the philosophy or the religion, or is it just a kind of a ambiguous name?
See, I think you're doing something Western there. You're making a distinction between philosophy and religion. I think the Taoists would reject that. They'd reject distinctions as uninformative often, so I think that may be an uninformative distinction. But, you know, to find out more, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukin Kalantari, to learn how some people get closer to the Tao, the way, through tea and music. She files this report.
I was asked not to eat garlic or onions or any meat for at least 24 hours by a guy named Cornelius Boots. He's a Taoist musician in the San Francisco Bay Area. He plays a long bamboo flute called the shakuhachi. Cornelius offered to take me along to a Taoist tea ceremony, but only if I didn't eat those foods beforehand. I agreed, and today we head to East Oakland.
Thank you.
Welcome, you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. Huh?
Thank you.
We meet Master Wong outside his home. He's a Taoist from China who specializes in tea and tea gods. He leads us into a long, narrow sunroom with wooden tables. Then Master Wong asks us to take off our shoes.
You guys want to do bell food?
Oh, sure.
To experience the food experience?
Yeah.
This is for massage, reflexology.
We sit down on polished tree stumps, and Master Wong pours us tiny cups of puer, a tea he just brought back from a 500-year-old tree in China.
Beautiful, huh?
I ask Master Wong, what's with the no garlic and meat thing?
Well, it's just your palate. You put a coat on your palate, then you will never meet the spirits behind the tea, which most people never meet all their life. Yeah, unless they uncoat. They take the coats off.
Master Wong says in addition to messing with your palate, garlic, onions, and meat make you stinky. And the gods don't like that.
There's a creator, there's a god, a tea god, behind every cup of tea, for real. Okay, they're angels. If you're smelly, right, the angels, they left. They're pretty picky, yeah. So.
Smell good for the angels?
Yeah, it's for yourself. For your spirit.
Master Wong says tea is Taoist medicine. The ceremonies are a way to emphasize the harmony between humans and nature. While you drink the tea, you have a direct connection with the spirit world, if your mind and body are clear enough.
Human beings are perfect still, if we are human being. You see the second word being? It's lost. We're just human doing, right? Because we're all of us lost that state of being.
Drinking tea brings Master Wong closer to the state of being. It's called Wu Wei, and it's one of the core values of Taoism.
Wu Wei is a difficult translation as actionless action or doing non-doing things that just sound contradictory and sort of ridiculous.
Cornelius Boots is the Taoist flute player who introduced me to Master Wong. In Taoism, music is a way to speak to the gods and to achieve Wu Wei.
When you're doing it, and when you've felt the benefit of that approach, then you know exactly what it is.
Cornelius says another important philosophy in Taoism is the art of non-attachment.
it would be a toss-up between wu-wei and non-attachment in terms of what the modern Western person could really benefit to understand. The idea that you can be fully engaged in something and yet not graspy about the results. To me, this is where a lot of our stress comes from.
Cornelius says a lot of things can bring us closer to the principles of Taoism. For him, it's music. For Master Wang, it's tea. But he says you can experience wu wei and non-attachment while you're on a hike or watching a beautiful sunset. Apparently, the Tao is everywhere. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for going out and drinking tea and taking a step towards wu wei. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about Taoism. We're following the way. We're joined now by Brian Van Orden. He's a professor of philosophy from Vassar College. He's a prolific author of books and translations of Chinese thought, and particularly Introduction to Classical Chinese Philosophy. Brian, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hi, Brian. Now, when you were at Stanford, there were all sorts of interesting Western ideas for you to get interested in, like mine. But instead, you went with Professor Nivison and got all involved in Chinese philosophy. How come?
Well, I'm part of that generation of students who were in high school after Mao Zedong passed away in 1976. And China opened to the West. And so there was this big surge in interest in China. And in addition, to be really honest, Bruce Lee's film Enter the Dragon came out in 1972, and I thought that was pretty cool. So for those reasons, I was very interested in China. Then when I became an undergraduate, I started to learn about China. I started to learn about philosophy. I started to decide I wanted to become a professional philosopher. And some of my philosophy professors told me, well, there's no such thing as Chinese philosophy. And so being the kind of person I am, I decided to go to graduate school to get a degree in Chinese philosophy to prove them wrong. And Stanford was one of the places where I could study it, so I came to Stanford with that intention.
Well, I'm glad you did. You added a lot to Stanford, and now you're adding a lot to Vassar, I'm sure. Now, can you give us a kind of a short account of what the Tao, the way, is supposed to be by your lights?
Sure. There's dispute about that, but I would say the way is a metaphysical entity which exists before the spatio-temporal universe as we know it, but it's responsible for the structure of the universe, and so it provides moral guidance if we're capable of following it, for how we should lead our lives. And the best way to follow it is, as your introduction suggests, in a way that manifests wu-wei, non-action, that is to say, non-self-conscious action.
Wow, that sounds really heavy. So the way is like, I mean, I don't know even how to restate that. It's like that timeless structure of the universe that was there before time, before space, for all something or other. Is that?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, one way to understand it, Wang Bi, an ancient Chinese commentator, said, look, the Tao can't be hot, or else it couldn't explain why things are cold. It couldn't be good, because then it couldn't explain why things are bad. It couldn't be tall, or it couldn't explain why things are short. So the Tao, the way, is what explains why things are the way they are, but because it has to account for contradictory qualities, it itself cannot have any of those limited qualities.
Well, that's a very intriguing argument. It reminds me of some of Socrates, according to Plato. But it sounds very metaphysical, but the action side of it sounds extremely interesting. It reminds me a little of Heidegger and his hammer. You have this selfless hammering. You see the hammer, you're using it as a tool. You are not involved, no self-knowledge. Is Heidegger a place we should look for something similar to Taoism?
There is a kind of similarity here. You're exactly right. So wu-wei, or non-action, is not just sitting there and doing nothing. It's acting in a kind of spontaneous way where you are not self-conscious about what you're doing. So just as Heidegger says, you know, if you're using a hammer correctly, you're not aware of the hammer as a hammer. You're just using it. when it doesn't work right, or if you don't know how to use a hammer, then it becomes this kind of weird alien object to you, and you're like, well, what do I do with this?
Well, this is obviously a profound philosophy, way beyond tea and music, but really profound. And we're going to have to dig in, and you're going to help enlighten us and show us the way, Brian. But first, I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're following the way of Taoism with Brian Van Norden, author of Introduction to Classical Chinese Philosophy.
The books of Taoism use sayings, stories, parables, and paradoxes more than the explicit argumentation one finds in most Western philosophy. In the next section, we'll get our guests to unravel some of these sayings.
The wit and wisdom of the way, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, I guess if the Tao tea ceremony won't do it, if that doesn't show you the way, or maybe you don't want to give up garlic, you can go to Peter Frampton and he'll show you the way. Or maybe Frampton is just another Taoist. Taoists embrace a philosophy that calls itself the way. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're following the ancient Chinese way of Taoism.
Our guest is Brian Van Norden from Vassar College.
So, you know, the Taoists love to tell stories and parables and all that stuff. And I remember one I encountered twice. Once in my youth on the TV show Kung Fu, I remember some wise old guy telling David Carradine this, and then I read it in college when I read the Chuang Tzu. It was about Chuang Tzu, I think it was, who dreamed he was a butterfly flitting about happily enjoying himself. He did not know that he was but then he woke up. But then he didn't know whether he was a man having dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly now dreaming he was a man. Now, I got to admit, that struck me as profound both times when I saw it heard it on television and when I read it in college. But I'm not quite sure what to make of it. Help me understand the point of that.
Yeah, well, that's probably the most famous story in the Zhuangzi. And ironically, I remember it from the show Kung Fu, too. That was the first time I encountered
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So embarrassing to admit, but true.
Yeah.
There's two major lines of interpretation. One assimilates the butterfly dream story to Descartes' dream argument.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners may, from other shows, remember that Descartes is trying to see what he can doubt. And he says, well, it's possible I'm dreaming. So all the facts about my life and the physical facts about the world could be mistaken, because this could all be a dream world, so you don't have knowledge. So some people think that's the point Zhuangzi is making. I think that's a little flat-footed, though. I think the point Zhuangzi is making is illuminated by other passages where Zhuangzi says that the sages of ancient times didn't draw distinctions between things.
Yeah.
They didn't distinguish themselves from horses. They didn't distinguish themselves from cows. So I think at that moment that Zhuangzi isn't sure whether he's a butterfly or a human, it's not supposed to be like the terrifying doubt that Descartes raises, where you're not sure what's true and what's false. It's touching and inspiring, because you're supposed to imagine this is what the world looks like to a sage, because the sage doesn't distinguish precisely between himself or herself and other things.
So now, Brian, in the introduction, we suggested that there's a little analogy between Heraclitus and Taoism. Heraclitus believes that the world is basically flux, becoming rather than being. And some of the things, like your interpretation of the story, suggest the kind of same thing. You know, just things are just happening. We try to put them into categories with our language, but all distinctions are artificial and you ought to go with the flow. But earlier you said, no, the Tao isn't the flow. The Tao is somehow this structure that predates, in some sense, the beginning of space and time. So which is it? Is Taoism Parmenidean or Heraclitian, or am I typically applying Western categories where they don't apply?
Yeah. Well, both in the two classic philosophical texts of Taoism, the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi, they both say that the Tao is something that, you know, Xian Tian Di in Chinese, it is before heaven and earth. So it's got to be, you know, metaphysical in that kind of sense. But although it's a structure, it's a structure that transcends any distinctions we can express in language. We tend to assume that if there's a structure, it has to be a structure that language could capture. But I think the Taoists would say there could be a structure, a pattern of the world, but one that any language is insufficient to capture because the distinctions in the world are too complex, and there's a level of arbitrariness in every distinction you make.
So let me back you up, because I know, I mean, there's a lot, and I just want to slow it down because I have a slow brain, Brian. But I just want to get back to the eternal thing. And the way, the 10,000, right? Because the way, the one gives birth to two, that gives birth to three, which gives birth to 10,000 things. I think of 10,000 things not as 10,000 things, but as the vast variety of things.
You're right, yeah.
But it sounds like, tell me if this is a right hearing of what you're, one thing you're saying. I mean, you're saying a couple different things. The right hearing of one thing you're saying is that the Tao is the ultimate ground of all these things. They are all equally somehow grounded in the Tao. So good is grounded in the Tao. Evil is grounded in the Tao. And if we, and somehow, I don't quite know how that makes for the non-distinctness of them, but if we distinguish X from Y and think that they're fundamentally different and fail to see that they're equally grounded in the Tao, we're not really seeing them or something like that. I mean, is that fair?
That's a good characterization, exactly. And this is the way people have classically read Taoism. There's an underlying unity that transcends all of our distinctions, and everything comes from that. So when we make distinctions between good and bad, right and wrong, beautiful and ugly, we're limiting things from a conventional human perspective and not doing justice to the underlying unity of things, which is the way.
So, and here I'm borrowing email from Brian in Boston, but...
A different Brian.
A different Brian, yes. So if the Tao is mainly something metaphysical, a certain picture of the universe is some combination of a flux and an order among the flux that we probably can't grasp and artificially treat with language. Okay, that sounds fine. But how do we get from this is to any ought? Because a lot of the texts are in the form of advice. How does our understanding of the Tao lead us to only speak what we don't know about? Or so always start our journeys with a single step? I guess that's fairly... hard to avoid. But anyway, how do you get the ought of Tao from the is of Tao?
Well, one terrific story Zhuangzi has is about a butcher who carves up an ox so amazingly skillfully that his ruler, who's watching, is just stunned and says, "Wow, this is just amazing. You're so skillful." And the butcher says, "What I really care about is the way, which transcends mere skill." And he says, when I'm carving up the ox, I don't see the ox anymore. Mm-hmm. I just follow the natural patterns of the ox. So you get this image of when you're following the way, what you're doing is you're spontaneously responding to that pattern in the world, not in a self-conscious way and not in a way that artificially projects your own preferences onto the world. So that's what it is to be in tune with the way.
That's really good, Brian. I was actually going to bring up that story. That's like my second favorite Zala story. And in that one, in that parable, he talks about the butcher who has to replace his knife every year, and then a skilled butcher has had his knife for 19 years and all that, but he has had his knife forever because it's kind of frictionless, this thing he does or something like that.
Exactly.
But I want to ask you, so why do they, I mean, so I love storytelling. I love it that the Taoists speak in parables. And I want to just ask you, I also love the way Descartes writes. But, you know, there's no mystery about what the dreaming argument is doing in Descartes. Even though it's a very narrative structure that's trying to draw you in, there's no mystery about why he's making the move he's making, the point of the radical doubt. But you said that the dreaming parable, in it's hard to figure out. I mean, why do they write this way? What is the mode of reflection that you're supposed to bring to these Taoist parables and aphorisms to help you get wisdom? Because they're really puzzling at times.
They are, and I think that's not accidental or just mischievous. I think of Zhuangzi as what we might describe as a therapeutic philosopher. That is to say, he's not trying to convince you of a particular doctrine. If you read his works and you became convinced of a particular doctrine, he'd say, well, that's just what I'm trying to talk you out of. But because of that, he can't just give you a straightforward sentence because there's a danger that you would take it as a theoretical claim. He's always got to undermine everything he says and make you see the world in new ways, but without becoming attached to particular doctrines. And he puts this in a really nice, yet another story. He says, you know, the fish trap exists to get a fish. When you get the fish, you can forget the trap. Words exist to get to the meaning. Once you got the meaning, you can get rid of the words. Where can I find somebody who's given up on words so I can have a word with him?
So Brian, now if I was being a little bit skeptical here. So sure. If you want your butcher's knife to last forever, the way is a good thing because, you know, you cut right along the joints and you don't wear it out. But apart from that, is it a good thing to act in this selfless way? It seems to be what I told my children was think before you act. Think about what you're doing. Think the impact of what you're doing. If I saw a butcher cutting up an ox, I might wonder, what's he got against oxen? I mean, in my vegetarian mood, I'd say, has he thought this through? Is this really a good thing to be doing? So why is it right to act in this kind of unselfconscious way? Why is that better than acting in a very self-conscious way?
Well, you're making an excellent point, and one way I put it with my students is Zhuangzi, in contrast with Confucians, presents us with a significant choice in life. You know, Confucians are committed to ethical value and to transforming society in a positive way. Zhuangzi invites us to take a much more skeptical look at all the sides in the ethical debates. So Zhuangzi would be neither pro-Republican nor would he be pro-Democrat, not pro-fascist, not pro-humanitarian. He'd be skeptical about all these positions, but as a result, you'd achieve a kind of calm detachment that would allow you to look with equanimity upon whatever happened in your personal life or whatever happened in society.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the way of Taoism. We'd love to have you follow the way to this conversation. And Tanya in Orinda's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tanya. What's your comment or question?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I really appreciate you actually went even deeper than I thought. I love the intellectual word lessons that you're sharing on the show today, and I'm wondering if one wanted to experience the Tao, where in the Bay Area could I go to actually have a being experience, not just the intellectual food?
Well, actually, it's funny because I think Zhuangzi would say the Tao is everywhere. So if you want to experience the Tao, find something that is like playing a musical instrument or carving up an ox or learning a martial art or practicing the tea ceremony or practicing flower arrangements. These are all activities in Chinese society that people practiced not just because they were beautiful or useful, although they might have been that. They're activities that put you in touch with the structure of the universe, and when you get good at them, you do them in a non-self-conscious way, just like the butcher carves the ox. So take up a craft, and that's all you have to do.
So Brian, my sister is a great Aikidoist. I guess that's how you say it. She has a dojo in Southern California and for a long time edited a magazine about Aikido. And that's a Japanese martial art, but the kinds of things she does and thinks about and the tea ceremony, those all seem to be very close to Taoism. Is Taoism something that had an influence on the martial arts, particularly as they developed in Japan?
Absolutely. And so Taoism had an influence throughout East Asia. And what happened was many of these Taoist ideas got absorbed by Buddhism when it came from India to China. And so East Asian Buddhism came to emphasize practical activities which allowed you to give up yourself and come into tune with that structure of the universe. And I studied Aikido as well. And yes, when you get good at a martial art, you're not thinking self-consciously about what you're doing. You're not afraid. You're not thinking about your opponent. You just react to what they're doing.
So Tanya maybe should look up in the phone book in Arinda and find an Aikido dojo.
That'd be fine.
So it sounds like, back to a question John asked me in our opening, and I snarled at him, you're making Western distinctions. But it sounds like there's a point here. I mean, we Westerners think of religious practices as these ritualized things with canonical texts that are sacred and scriptures written down, system of prohibitions together with the metaphysics, right? But the metaphysics is a revealed metaphysics, right? Now, is Taoism, it sounds like it's kind of ritualized, but not in the way that a liturgy is ritualized. Is there a Taoist liturgy?
There actually is. It's a little complicated because the philosophical thinkers we're talking about existed first, and then several centuries later in the Han Dynasty, an actual Taoist religion developed, and the religion involved things like dietary practices, what we might call, to use the Indian term, yogic practices, incantations, elixirs, and some of these were supposed to give the practitioners magical powers. And when you read Zhuangzi, he does say that people can do things like the sage can't be burned, the sage can't be drowned. And as a philosopher, I think these are metaphors for the detachment the sage achieves. But in later religious Taoism, some people said, no, through the right kinds of practices, the sage actually can fly or become invulnerable to fire.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Shirley in Fremont has sent us an email with an interesting question that I hadn't heard. She says that she's read somewhere that Taoism was an oral tradition predominantly perpetuated by women before these great books were written. Do you have any illumination on that topic?
Well, the thing is, as you pointed out in the intro, Taoism is a label that later Chinese thinkers applied retrospectively to certain philosophers. So the notion that there was a previous Taoist tradition that was either male or female is probably not accurate. However, it is true that you had in the Taoist tradition priestesses. And Confucians and even Buddhists were sometimes very upset about the level of freedom that the Taoist priestesses had and the fact that they were able to mix with the men at court, mm-hmm. which they found kind of scandalous.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're following the way, asking about Taoism with Brian Van Orden from Vassar College.
The China I grew up with was Maoist. But in the long run, perhaps Chinese Taoism will be more lasting than Chinese Maoism.
Which is dead.
Well, not entirely in China. But what does Taoism teach contemporary Taoists in China and the rest of the world? That's what we're going to look at next.
The Tao and the Now, when Philosophy Talk continues.
So that was Aerosmith telling us to walk this way. I suppose Lao Tzu and other Chinese philosophers could give us advice on how to walk, selflessly and so forth. I don't know how they'd feel about a Fitbit. That seems kind of an overly self-conscious way to walk. But at any rate, I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Brian Van Orden from Vassar College. And we're thinking about Taoism, that is, following the way. And we've got a caller on the line, Dave from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thank you. And I'll just ask if you can hear me okay.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, good. Well, mine is a contrast between Westerners and Easterners, and it's a question. We Westerners, of which I am one, view past, present, and future with careful outlines as a structure. How would they talk about past, present, and especially future?
Yeah, I don't want to speak
Are they equal entities or what?
That's a good question, Dave. I don't want to speak for all Westerners because, that's a complicated thing. But how did the Taoists view the passage of time, the flow of time?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right to not want to generalize over, you know, West or East, because you do get a bunch of different views in the East about time. But part of acting with uwe or non-action is just being able to adapt flexibly to whatever time you're in and not being attached to things that happened in the past with a kind of unhealthy nostalgia, and also not ruining the present by worrying too much about what's happening in the future.
So this sounds like a kind of Stoic equanimity, right? The Stoics think Zeus is going to take care of everything, and to get too invested in this or that outcome is to be misguided and to lose yourself, to make yourself a prisoner of mere fortune, which there really isn't any mere fortune because Zeus guides all things. How does the Taoist kind of detachment relate to Stoic detachment?
There is an important similarity. So the Zhuangzi talks about a sage whose body is rotting, like he has leprosy or something like that. And a friend of his says, well, do you resent this? And he says, why should I resent it? Heaven gave me a body when it's time, and it'll take it away when it's time for it to go. And as long as I learn to accept what's happening, my preferences or dislikes aren't going to enter my heart to bother me.
So that sounds like a very nice Stoic type of philosophy. Not typically the philosophy that a revolutionist like Mao Zedong would aspire to. Now, Maoism, of course, had a big influence on China. I don't think it's all that popular now, based on my recent visit. But is Taoism going to fill the void? Is it the Chinese I see in the news does not seem all that laid back, unself-reflective in approaching things stoically. It seems like a combination of super capitalism with a sort of authoritarian government. Is Taoism making a comeback? Is it relevant to Chinese now?
Can I interject something here too? Because this may be ignorant, but I think of the Maoist as having thought of themselves as having to root out the Confucianism of Chinese culture, but not so much the Taoism of the then contemporary Chinese culture. Did the Taoists or the Confucianists win the hearts and minds of China over the long terms? And then, you know, I mean, so this whole network of how do we think about Chinese culture in light of these ancient and modern Chinese philosophy?
Well, you're right. The Maoism was radically opposed to traditional thought, and particularly in the Cultural Revolution of 66 to 76, religion was just outlawed, and it didn't make any difference whether it was Christianity, Confucianism, Buddhism, or Taoism. They were just forbidden. And to some extent, Taoism has not recovered from that. So you are seeing the beginnings of some, you know, restoration of Taoism in China now. But largely what you're seeing in China is Confucianism coming back, which has a lot of government support because the government thinks that Confucius can be a useful figure for Chinese
nationalism. If you wanted to sum up the difference between Taoism and its cultural outlook and Confucianism and its cultural outlook, how would you... I know that's a complicated question, and we can't do full justice to it, but give us partial justice to it.
Well, I mean, as I was suggesting earlier, I think for the Taoist, a lot of Taoism is apolitical, and it's about being able to look ironically upon the conventional values of society, including political and individual values, whereas Confucianism is about taking ethical values really seriously and trying to change society in a positive way according to those values.
We've got a caller, Keith in San Francisco, who wants to, I think, weigh in on a related point of this kind. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Keith. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. It is very directly on what you were just talking about, as well as what you were discussing earlier. I'm very interested in finding out what are Taoist ethics, or can Taoism be described sort of unethical, without ethical? I mean, basically, go with the flow and that's it.
Yeah, so is there a Taoist ethics? Thanks for the call, Keith. Is there a Taoist ethics, Brian?
Well, again, in religious Taoism, you know, you get very specific, you know, prohibitions and rules. But in philosophical Taoism, you can, in a way, read it as amoral, because morality is one of those conventional distinctions we project onto the world. And if you see the world as it is, there's a way that you will spontaneously act, But developing a moral system would be an imposition on that world, which would distort your perception and prevent you from acting.
I think I remember reading in the Chuangzi something, somebody's asking the master, somebody, about right and wrong and blah, blah, blah. And the master responds something like, that's how you get the rights and wrongs of the Confucian, as if that was a bad thing to do, right?
Exactly, exactly. And it's a part of a critique of morality, and they mock both the Confucians and the other schools, saying they're all wrong, not because they don't have the right morality, but because they have a morality which they insist on foisting on others.
So does that mean, I sometimes wonder about these kinds of Eastern philosophy, if they're preaching indifference in a certain way to the plight of humanity. So, like, I sometimes wonder about Buddhism. Okay, here's the conqueror's army marching into your homeland and taking over your villages and crushing, you know, and what are you supposed to do? Rise up in revolution and resistance? But if it's just the universe expressing itself in the multiple ways that it expresses itself, I sometimes wonder, where does it get, can it have, a philosophy of resistance?
That's actually a very good question, and if you read the Zhuangzi, one of Zhuangzi's friends says to him his philosophy is useless, with the implication being it has no political implications. And Zhuangzi said, you ever seen a weasel? A weasel runs around and it tries to get the rats, but in the end it ends up in a snare and dies.
Yeah, yeah. And he tells his story of an old oak tree, I think it is, some huge tree that's grown forever and ever, but it would make bad firewood and bad wood for the boats and this, that, and the other thing. And somebody says, what a useless tree. But then somebody tells in the story how its very uselessness is the key to its survival, as if you try to make yourself useful to the world will just crush you.
Exactly, exactly. And so, but it's not a kind of, you know, selfish survival, because if you were selfish, that would be another kind of attachment.
So we talked earlier about Taoism and its connection with martial arts, but the martial arts, particularly in Japan, looked at through the eye of Western moviegoers with Bruce Lee and the like, they don't seem very passive. They don't seem like being a tree that just kind of doesn't get chopped down because it's so useless. They seem like, you know, agents out to change the world and kill the criminals and stuff like that. So what's is there a disconnect there?
Well, ironically, I mean, Bruce Lee had studied some philosophy, and he interpreted what he did in terms of Taoism, and he said, I don't strike my opponent. My opponent strikes himself with my fist, which is paradoxical, but the idea is his kicks and his punches are spontaneously responding to what his opponent does. He's not thinking of himself as separate from his opponent and worrying about whether he wins or loses. He's just spontaneously responding.
Well, that sounds a lot like my sister, except I do think she cares whether she wins or loses.
We've got time for one last caller, if you're quick. Mike in Crawley Lake, be very brief.
Very brief. If you're looking for the way, just a suggestion, go down to the river. Throw a stick into the water. Watch the way the stick goes. The stick knows the way.
Good quote, Mike.
Worthy
so
of
what do you think of that? Last thought, probably. What do you think of that thought? It sounds like something out of the novel Siddhartha, to tell you the truth.
But. Yeah, in a sense, that's right. I mean, there's, we learn to follow it. It's just that we're sticks who have this tendency to start swimming when we shouldn't.
If I'm a contemporary, one last thought. If I'm a contemporary person, would be the most attractive thing for living a 21st century life about Taoism?
Well, I find that many of my students are very stressed today because they have all these expectations put on them by themselves, their family, their society. If we could look at things a bit more ironically and recognize that things aren't intrinsically important that we think are important, students often find that very liberating and relaxing. It's a way of escaping stress when you realize it's just a social expectation that you be the top of your class or you go to medical school. It's not intrinsically important to the universe.
Well, that's a good thought. I mean, so the letting go element could let you live more at ease in a world that's pushing you and pulling you this way and that way.
Students don't think of that unless somebody suggests it to them as a possibility.
That's why they go to college and study with people like you, Brian. And I'm going to, on that note, I'm going to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Well, thank you very much, guys.
Our guest has been Brian Van Orden. He's a professor of philosophy from Vassar College. He's author of numerous translations and books on Chinese thought, a real world-class expert, including Introduction to Classical Chinese Philosophy. So, John, in what way are your thoughts led today?
Well, to tell you the truth, Ken, the first article I ever published was on Zen Buddhism.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
In philosophy, East and West. I was very interested in Eastern philosophy when I was in college, and that's when I published that article. But then when I got to graduate school at Cornell and then trying to earn tenure at Stanford, that wasn't a natural way to do it, since I didn't know Chinese and since nobody cared except Professor Nivison. But now that I'm retired, my interest is coming. I've always been drawn to philosophies, both East and West, like Heraclitus, or Mahayana Buddhism, or Alfred North Whitehead, that see the world as flux, as becoming, as a process, rather than the kind of substance and attribute philosophy. And so maybe as I kind of have the untethered life of the retiree, I'll get back into Chinese philosophy.
I hope you do, John. That would be fascinating to see what you come up with. I've been your friend and colleague for 20 some years, and I learned something new about you today. See how the 10,000 things about a person.
Exactly. Just throw me in a water, throw me in a stream, and watch me float. You'll learn a lot.
Or sink, as the case may be.
Or sink.
But anyway, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is very, very Western, I admit. Cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community just by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's follow the Tao of Speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Tao is one of those Eastern concepts that the West loves to appropriate. Frankly, I'm not sure exactly what it means in its original context. Something like the way or the path, but it's not a roadmap or a GPS app. It's more like an attitude or a framework for beliefs, only organic, holistic. I'm embarrassed to think about it, really. Ambiguity is anathema to me. I'm an American, after all. It's like the way we hijack the word karma, which in Western mouths means something like vengeance or just desserts. It's the surprise ending in a Twilight Zone. The glutton gets buried by food. That's karma, man. Instant karma, even. Same thing with Tao. Look at the many Taos we've unleashed over the years, most famously the Tao of Poo, a huge bestseller back in the early 80s that supposedly explained the concept of Tao through the mouths of babes, or the lips of poo in this case. It was on the bestseller list for a year, which means that either a lot of people gained a closer understanding of Taoism thanks to a children's book, or a lot of people became deeply confused by a children's book thanks to Taoism. The jury may still be out, but that was just the tip of the iceberg. There was a movie called The Tao of Steve about a guy who would channel the essence of Steve McQueen to gain girlfriends. There was the bestseller The Tao of Wu by RZA, about the hidden ways of the Wu-Tang Clan, which incorporated Buddhism, RZA's attempted murder charge, and Bruce Lee movies. I have seen The Tao of Panda Express, Maya Loma, Werner Herzog, Internet Relay Chat, and Louis C.K. It's all part of the Tao of Google, from whence cometh all things. Another famous example would be The Tao of Physics, a 1975 book by Fritjof Capra, which I am told misinterprets physics and Taoism in equal measure. Then there's the Tao of Tennis, the Tao of Tea, the Tao of Twitter, which Google tells me takes the mystery out of Twitter. I didn't think Twitter was enigmatic myself, but there's also the Tao of Trump, who I always thought was about as free of mystery as you can get. But who knows? Tao in the Western world presents the illusion of an explanation, but in the explanation makes a thing more mysterious than it really is. Not like a phone book or Wikipedia or a guide. It's more like a gestalt, a feeling, an intuition about a thing, an intuition that proves true merely because you had it. The Tao of Physics. Yes, physics now has a Tao because the phrase Tao of Physics has been uttered. It's that simple. So it's not like the instruction manuals that American men refuse to read. It's the Tao of IKEA, which has something to do with Allen wrenches, naturally, but ends up with a bunch of bookcases all assembled backwards. And that's okay, because you're feeling good about yourself. That's all that matters. As John Stewart used to say, here's your moment of Zen, which had nothing to do with Zen, of course, but that's the Tao of American culture in a nutshell, isn't it? C'est là. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
From eternity, I'm Stephen Colbert. John.
Thanks for that report, Stephen. Here it is, your name is.
I love you, John Stewart. I love you.
Please tell me that's the toss and we just finished it.
Why not?
I have no problem with that.
I have no problem with that either. Can we do that?